All right, I'll talk about the CMB polarization experiments that I've been involved in, and also perhaps comment on the general status of the field and where this is going. I have to apologize for my weak voice. I'm recovering from a cold. So as you know, there are several remaining questions in fundamental cosmology. I'm sure you're all aware of these. we don't know exactly what the spectral index of the initial perturbation. So far, we've only seen the scalar perturbation, and we don't know exactly what that number will be. And Planck will measure that number very well. And of course, that's related to inflation and how scalar perturbation was generated and all of that. Planck will also do a very good job in characterizing the primordial Nangaussianity in the temperature and isotropy, which is related to, again, fundamental interactions in the early universe. And also whether the mode of the perturbation is adiabatic or isocurvature, again, Planck will do a fantastic job on limiting the amount of perhaps isocurvature perturbation. Deviation of flatness, you know, there's still, we should leave that option open. And again, Planck will do a great job. What can't Planck do is essentially the focus of my talk here in terms of polarization. Of course, we don't know what dark matter is. That's not what I'm talking about. And Planck will not be able to do a very good job at constraining the nature of dark energy, just because the way CMB works. Planck may or may not be able to constrain the tensor to scalar ratio in the primordial perturbation, and I'll comment on that later. Okay, so this is a stated goal for Planck as well, and I'll comment on, you know, how difficult that is versus a ground base or balloon base effort. And finally, we don't know what the absolute neutrino mass is, and since we don't know its effect on cosmology and growth of structure. Okay. So this is the boilerplate CMB introduction.
Yeah.
Sorry? And degeneracy with many other parameters. But since Planck will have such excellent sensitivity over a wide range of L, it'll just, it'll just do a very good job. So as you know, CMB is this boundary between ionized media and neutral media. And there's a lot of free electrons here, and everything is thermal, okay? So you have to kind of remember that all the time. So you're seeing thermal radiation essentially. And on top of the thermal radiation, there's temperature variation, okay? And because of the temperature variation, it naturally generates polarization, and I'll get to that. And even before Planck, we were doing a very good job measuring this temperature angular power spectrum, and you all know. It constrains many, many parameters to very good accuracies from WMAP and other ground-based experiments. So just based on the fact that there are free electrons and there's temperature perturbation, you expect CMB fluctuation to be polarized. So go to the rest frame of an electron. And it's seeing this bath of thermal radiation, okay? And just because of the Thomson scattering, the electron scatters off this thermal radiation. So if the electron in question sees a isotropic blackbody radiation at 2.7 Kelvin, the scatter light will not be polarized. Of course, there's no symmetry. The break to make a scalar light polarize. But if there is a Okay, so you can do harmonic, spherical harmonic analysis on the radiation field that the electron sees. So first of all, there is monopole component. As I just said, if no matter how big the monopole is, the electron will not be able to scatter a polarized light off that monopole radiation path. And then there's dipole. It turns out dipole has the wrong symmetry to give you a polarization either. Okay? And there's quadrupole. And in fact, that's the only thing that will generate a linear polarization from Thomson scattering. So an electron is sitting there, seeing this very complicated radiation bath pattern, and it only takes the quadrupole moment of that bath and gives you a linear polarization of that quadrupole in the direction of that quadrupole. Okay? So that's a known fact. Just based on this very simple geometry. You know, you can write down equations and convince yourself of that. It's not sensitive to any other higher multiples, and it's not sensitive to monopole or dipole, okay? So once you have ionized electrons sitting in a quadrupole radiation field, it gives you a linear polarization in the direction of the quadrupole. This was known for 40 years. I think Martin Rees realized this first, soon after CMB was discovered. Okay, and it's easy to figure out the direction of the polarization just from looking at how electron oscillates in EM wave. A photon propagating in this direction could be linearly polarized in either this direction or in the perpendicular direction. If it's polarized in this direction, then it scatters the electron. So say this is the observer direction. Okay? It scatters the electron and it will be polarized in this direction. That's this red direction here. If it's polarized in this direction, yes, it'll scatter off the electron as well, but it won't be, the scatter light won't be able to propagate in your direction, in this direction, because it's perpendicular. So you imagine this electron is responding to this electric field by oscillating in this direction. So looking at the electron from this direction, you see no motion at all, so it's not going to scatter light. So the scattered light from this hot source from the electrons will be only polarized in this direction. In other words, the polarization in this direction measures the amount of radiation in the up and down direction, okay? Oh, sorry. And in the perpendicular direction, it works similarly. In the end, only this polarization survives after scattering and reaches the observer. So in the end, you're taking the difference between the temperature around the electron versus the top and bottom temperatures. So that's why I said about the quadrupole anisotropy. The quadrupole anisotropy gives you linear polarization in the direction of the quadrupole anisotropy. And all the rest of the CMB phenomenology, CMB polarization phenomenology, came from this fact, this simple argument. So we can take this a little bit further. So again, this is your electron, this is your quadrupole anisotropic field. It Thomson scatters. Originally we consider in the perpendicular direction, but now we consider in general in all possible directions, okay? And it's easy to convince yourself that once again, if this is the direction of the observer, the polarization will be correlated with the direction of the quadrupole anisotropy. Okay? So originally we considered only the perpendicular. Now we consider a general direction. Okay, so this is your direction of the quadrupole. Okay? And this is the scatter direction, and this will be the direction of polarization. Okay? If you have a quadrupole, okay, lined up in this direction. So this is a simple extension. And let's consider planar Fourier density mode in 3D. because everything can be decomposed. Any density perturbation can be decomposed into planar Fourier density modes, okay? And some of the Fourier density modes. So let's just consider one single planar Fourier density modes, like stacks of hot, warm, or dense, dilute materials. Okay, so it sees, the electrons will see quadruple anisotropy in that direction, scatters preferentially, polarized in one direction that's correlated with this direction of the Fourier moment. I'm about to visually convince you of the famous BMO theorem in CMB polarization, okay? So taking this graph, again, this is the direction of the planar Fourier mode, and this is the direction of the observer. But, you know, from the observer's perspective, directions seems like points on the sky. So K, this direction, will appear as a point on the sky. And say your electron is located at multiple directions, multiple places. That's the origin of the electron. So you're observing the electron from, say this is the plane of the sky, and you are measuring polarization at this point. And you tell yourself, okay, so we just consider one Fourier mode, and that Fourier mode has the direction in K, okay? So then the polarization generated from the scattered electron at this point caused by a planar Fourier mode in the K direction will be polarized in this direction, because we just agreed that this is the direction of polarization. Okay, that's correlated with the direction of K. And projected on the sky, it looks something like this. This was known since the Renaissance or something, you know, how people make drawings of buildings, and it looks like something like this. This is the infinity, so it becomes a direction. In other words, if you take a circular integral around a loop, the linear polarization, if you project it in the direction of either the r, projected the vector in the direction of the r vector, it'll cancel out. Okay, so this thing has left-right symmetry with respect to the direction of the origin. Okay, so and so this circle, if you measure the linear polarization, has only so-called E mode. It doesn't have the twist E mode. If you rotate all these vectors by 10 degrees, you have a little twist. But you can twist it in this direction, but on the opposite side, you have to twist it back, because it's all coming from one Fourier mode. And of course, the next step is to sum up all the possible Fourier modes. And since you can't generate any twist, any curl from one Fourier mode, it can't generate any curl from any possible linear combination.
So it must be a quadrupole to explain.
Yes.
So why, this sounds like a dipole. You could just put
it
one Fourier mode.
Okay, so.
Sorry.
This is hot and cold. The electron sees hot in this direction and sees cold in all the horizontal directions. So this is, it sees a quadrupole. And it scatters, you know, in this direction. It gives you this linear polarization. Okay? So it's just as simple as that. So any scalar perturbation in 3D scattered off electron can only generate this type of polarization. Okay, so this is the BMO theorem. So this is the twisted BMO that's completely forbidden if you only have scalar perturbation. So this is the allowed BMO. Okay, any questions on that? I think it's worth, you know, kind of get on the same page at this point, because we have 1 hour. Is that clear? Okay. So, so this is the great tool in cosmology. So any polarization field can be linearly decomposed to EMB mode. Again, you know, it's a complete set of bases. Okay, a linear polarization field on the sky is either E or B, or a linear combination of E or B. If you measure polarization field on the sky, you decompose it into E and B, you only expect to see E mode if there's only scalar perturbation and everything is linear. It's also worth reminding everybody that there is no cosmic variance in the BMO theorem. By that I mean this is an exact symmetry. You measure this and you detect any twist at all. That means there is a violation of either linearity or scalar perturbation, or there's gravity wave. So there's no cosmic variance.
Actually, this argument where have you used linearity?
Oh, taking the next step, okay? So this is one Fourier mode, but any arbitrary perturbation, linear perturbation, generates all kinds of crazy patterns. But using linearity, you know, if you don't have linear polarization in one, curl polarization in one case, you won't have it. In other words, if your theory predicts a huge B mode at L of 3, you don't have to worry that it will be contaminated by cosmic variance. Okay? Even though there's, you know, you just hear there's huge cosmic variance at L of 3. But if you detect anything at all, that means you've seen it. Because
from that
kind of no, it's no chance.
You know, B still has cosmic variance.
Yes, if you want to measure the amplitude of that B mode, it's subject to cosmic variance. If you see three, if you see B mode and it's measured to be three, and it's at L of three, you know, it's three plus minus, you know, a range. But the likelihood that it's zero, it's zero. It's exactly zero. There's no way you can, you know, see three just from a variable that has variance of zero. Do you, can you get? Okay, so this is very important to remind everybody. That's why this is a great tool. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Are you saying that it's easy to detect?
I'm not saying it's easy to detect.
I mean, you need to measure the polarization very well to
yes, to yes. You need to measure polarization very well, and the error in that measurement is your instrumentation error, you know, and so on. But there's no cosmic variance in detecting the existence of B mode. There's huge cosmic variance if this is a low L B mode in measuring the amplitude of that beam, but the existence has no cosmic variance. I think it's worth pointing out again. So this is the current state of the art as of last summer. Didn't change from last summer to today. So we didn't even bother plotting the temperature and anisotropy anymore because it's huge. And it's measured very well. So this is the temperature to E mode cross polarization plotted as a function of L. Because of the fact that we've only seen E mode polarization so far, right? And because of the fact that the E mode polarization comes from density perturbation in the way that I just spent 10 minutes described, there's correlation between T and E. Oh, I'll get to that. That's okay. I'll get to that. I'll get to that. Yeah, in the next. Okay. Right. So at some places it has negative cross correlation, and some places it has positive cross correlation. So there's a unique signature, and it was measured and confirmed very well. You can take away some noisy plots, but the bottom line is if you just take all the data in the world and spin it up nicely, you see a very nice confirmation of the standard paradigm that E-mode is caused by density perturbation. And of course there's EE autocorrelation. Again, it all fits well with the theory. In fact, you can predict what the E-mode will look like just based on the cosmological parameter. And you draw a line, it looks pretty much like this one. So there's fantastic agreement between theory and observation. And I'm personally involved in this experiment called BICEP. That's the black points. So this experiment is specifically targeting the B-mode that's coming from gravity waves or tensor mode perturbation. So like I just said, if it's tensor mode or gravity wave, it generates B-mode. Or if linearity is violated, you generate B-mode. Okay? And this is where the nonlinear phenomena comes in. So this is called a phenomenon called gravitational lensing. So it's the second order term because you have to lens an already small signal by a small amount. So it's a delta square kind of phenomena where delta is the perturbation. Okay, so it's clearly a nonlinear effect and that generates B mode. Fortunately, that B mode and the gravitational wave generated B mode are occupied different angular scale in space. Okay, so this corresponds to arcminute scale polarization on the sky, and this corresponds to a few degrees or 1 degree. So the size of the moon is half a degree.
So
Out of E mode. So you have E mode.
So that is the second small thing. E mode is more than Lansing or E mode.
Yes, yes. So E mode is located far, and then you have dark matter and galaxies in between. That twisted the direction and the apparent direction of the CMB a little bit, and that distort the whole, you know, nice B mode theorem. So that creates this specific gravitational lensing B-mode. So, and these black points are data from BICEP. So it's currently the world leading experiment in constraining B-mode, especially the gravity generated, gravity wave generated B-mode.
Is that like any of the constraints or just constraints on any source of B-mode at all?
Oh, we are experimentalists. We have no idea what we're looking at, you know, whether it's primordial or, you know. You guys should tell us whether this is primordial. We put a constraint on B mode. We measure the sky. We do our vector analysis. And this is our limit. We have seen no B mode so far.
The vertical axis is the same in all three.
Different scales. If you see, this is plus minus 100 microkelvin square, this is, you know, one microkelvin.
It's still the 10 to the 2, it's still 100 microkelvin square.
The temperature.
I'm looking at.
So this goes to negative because this has negative correlation, and these are all positive definite. You know, this is log. This is a positive.
Numbers are always in microkelvin square.
The E-mode polarization is in the a few microkelvin square. We don't know where this is located. We know pretty well where this is at. But the fact that the points appear at the right place is just experimental because our error in B is similar to our error in E.
About the third plot, there seems to be quite a lot of difference from the different experiments. Do you have an explanation?
Yeah, so that's the cosmic variance. So because there is a big signal in E, but we only measure a small patch of the sky, the amplitude, the exact amplitude of that is subject to cosmic variance. Okay. For example, in these upper limits, there are no cosmic variance. because this is purely instrumental. So there's, as you know, there's global experimental effort searching for beam mode, especially in the US. So I'm personally involved with the first two. So these experiments are at different stages. In fact, with the exception of BICEP, which produces these best limit so far, there are no data from any of these experiments so far. Okay. So BICEP, BICEP2, Keck array, and I'll show you the experiment, how it looks. Specifically targets this degree scale stuff here because we use smaller telescopes, which has poor angle resolution, meaning the error bar will blow up at around L of 200 or something, or 300, okay? So you see that train, okay? But it's very good if you want to constrain this gravity wave.
You're talking about the left, the content orbit on the right.
Yes.
But there's some program on the
left. I'll talk about that. So that's galactic emission. That's our emission for our own galaxy.
But that's still below where you've
existed too small. So I'll talk about that.
Okay. You keep asking, have you seen a beam mode yet?
Right. We have not seen a beam mode in the direction we look at. But if we point it in the direction of the galaxy, you will definitely see beam. In fact, we have seen beam mode or whatever mode in the direction of the galaxy. Yes, sure. That means our experiment is working. So this series uses small telescopes. You'll see a picture of it, and. They're only good for one thing, for measuring tensor mode perturbation. They're operating at 2 millimeters or 3 millimeters, where there's not much astronomy to do, but that's a good thing for what we're doing. And the angular resolution for these experiments is half a degree. And again, there's not much astronomy you can do with a telescope that poor. But it has very, very good microwave sensitivity. Polarization sensitivity between a degree and 10 degrees. Okay, so this is only specifically designed for this experiment. I'll talk about Polar One and Polar Array. So Polar One is a recently funded effort, and I'll discuss that. So these experiments are located or will be located at the South Pole because we operate at 2 millimeters, and if you observe at 2 millimeters here, you see an opaque sky, essentially. So we go to an exotic location where there's not much 2 millimeter radiation.
But do you need more water?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. I appreciate that. All right. So I think these are mostly US, as it turns out. With the exception of Planck, and there's a lot of Canadian participation. So these are, you know, coarse angular scale experiments. BICEP2 is in the field. Keck array will be in the field in less than a year. We're assembling, we're putting together Keck array receivers as I speak. ABS is similar to BICEP2, except it's located at Princeton. Polar Bear is a slightly larger telescope, a Berkeley-based experiment trying to cover slightly wider range into lensing. Let me pause for a moment and see if you have questions, or if there's an experiment that you heard of, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, on the
pictures,
is there anything that you
Right. So WMAP will not be able to have any direct sensitivity on BMO. So WMAP published an upper limit on tensor mode, but that's extremely model dependent. Essentially, they try to fit the temperature data by throwing in different components of tensor mode to see how that affects the temperature in isotropy. They didn't directly search for the tensor mode, but there is indeed an upper limit from WMAP.
These are all funded and being built, except for BICEP, which you said is done, and SAP kind of applying for Clean Auto.
BICEP is done. BICEP 2 is observing. This is funded. We're putting together. And this was funded as of last week. And this is our grand dream, as I will show you later. Quiet 2 is funded. Quiet 1 is funded. Quiet 1 is analyzing its data. It uses a completely different technology, and I think that's very good. It's a healthy situation. Quiet 2 is a huge expansion upon Quiet 1. It's quite likely that it'll be funded at some level. And South Pole Telescope and ACT, so this is a little bit further ahead than ACT, because ACT has not been funded for the polarimeter yet. But SPD Pole has been funded. So they have much better angular resolution. So unless they really want to do the degree scale science and compete with other experiment, they will be, their prime target will be this lensing beam.
Is there interesting
astrophysics
to do with that
lensing? Yes, I'll get to that. Mm-hmm.
So why are you so in the sense that, what are the parameters you're varying as you go through here?
It's technology, angular resolution, site, and group.
And what?
Groups, different groups.
Yeah, well, it would be nice to have more than one measurement, but will you show the characteristic sensitivities of these different?
So, that's a highly controversial thing to do, but let me just say, let me just say this. There used to be more, a lot more experiments, and they kind of die out on the way, you know. And if you look at this plot very carefully, the leading experiment on degree angular scale and the leading experiment on arcminute angular scale came from the same group, using the same detectors at the same site. Okay, let me just stop. So, CBI uses interferometers. It was very nice. They actually got the first detections with along with DAISY. Well, that's kind of either a dead technology or a technology for the future. So right now, it's very hard to expand that greatly. Let me refrain myself from criticizing other experiments. But the situation is not as chaotic as you think it is, because
turn off the mic. you can't.
But like I said, Quiet 1 and Quiet 2 uses different technology, completely different from everything else here. So it's healthy.
I just wanted to
hear. Right. Yes, I could do that. I could do that. I can do that just based on the number of detectors. Okay. BICEP 2 has 50 detectors, so that's a done deal. Bicep, sorry. Bicep 2 has 250. Keck is 1,000, okay? Polar 1 is 2,000. Polar Array is 20,000. So like I said, this is a grand dream, okay? Abs is on the order of 700 or something. So it's somewhere, you know, in this range, okay? Polar Bear is also somewhere in this range. So I would say these three are competing experiments, okay? And I think all three are coming from very good groups, okay? And this one uses a completely different technology, coherent detectors as opposed to direct power detectors. And these are just simply much larger telescopes. So SPT is a 10-meter telescope. So it was designed and built to do something else, to do Sinev-Zeldovich cluster surveys, and they think they will be done with that science in 2 more years, and they want to put a polarimeter on it. So does ACT. There's essentially a ballooning effort. It's, you know, ballooning, you get a little better sensitivity, but shorter integration time compared to ground base. But again, I think both experiments are in pretty healthy state. Spider is similar to Keck, between Keck and Bicep 2 perhaps, a few hundred or 1,000, something like that. EBEX is about 600. The EBEX was supposed to deliver results a few years before, but you know, ballooning is quite hard, so. There's been delays. Yes?
In one question, when it comes to the upper limits that Bicep has used in the lower L regime,
right.
If you assume that that is from a tensor mode, what limit on R would that give?
Oh, that's about 0.6.
0.6.
So it's surprisingly high. However, because we've just detected E mode at much, much higher significance than 1.2 sigma. We probably detected E mode at, I don't know, 20 sigma or 100 sigma or something like that. However, B mode is naturally damped in the plasma process. So the fact you don't see B mode doesn't mean it wasn't there. That just means it's damped as the theory predicts. So the fact that, you know, we didn't see BMO mostly is coming from the fact that it's natural event. So we kind of verify the theory of plasma, you know, generated E mode. But so far we're starting to dig into the primordial limit. We're just starting to do that.
How much do you think you can go down?
If all these experiments claim their sensitivity is limited by atmosphere, by background. If that's the case, their survey speed is proportional to the number of detectors. So Bicep has 50, and you know we were talking about 20,000 detectors in the future. So this will move down greatly in the next few years. Okay, so this is the site. Yes. So, and I have a slide for that. Okay, so this is the size of Bicep and the size of the collaboration. Okay, so it's a small telescope, relatively small collaboration. Sorry? The picture was taken in 2005. And there's Andrew, who just passed away. So, we installed Bicep in November 2005. At the South Pole Station, there's, you know, not much going on other than this. And then there's a 10-meter SPT right here. And that's bigger than the whole building.
Also, Ice Cube at the
Ice Cube is in this direction, and when I was there, it was generating lots of plume smoke because they were drilling the core to put in their PMTs. pretty annoying. So the reason we can go from 50 detectors to thousands is because of the silicon revolution, essentially. So these are 50 or 49 V-horns in the bicep 1 focal point. These are all hand assembled by grad students, you know, with discrete parts. We spent a lot of time working on new detectors. These are completely lithographic on a silicon wafer. All the components, like the V-horn, the filters, detectors, are all lithographic. So you get much higher packing density and much cheaper production. We'll get into the details. But this is the focal point of the bicep 2 array, okay? So this is to be compared with this focal point. Okay, roughly the same size, just completely different detectors, okay? So that one has 50, this one has 250, just because of the change of technology. So each wafer is about this big, okay? And this is a silicon wafer, and each wafer is made of 64 detectors. And each detector has this complicated antenna structure that synthesizes the beam just like a V-horn would, and send the two polarization signals to two detectors. It's the blowout of the detectors, some of the antennas, and the summing network. Yes, I spent a lot of time looking on this detector. Just want to show off the beautiful hardware to this group. Even very small things can be annoying. For example, this is a circuit board, and this is the detector wafer. This is the squid readout. You see these traces? Oh, big deal. You know, we have traces on circuit boards for hundreds of years, except these are aluminum because we need them to be superconducting. And anybody seen an aluminum circuit board? No. So we have to do it ourselves. And so, yeah. Aluminum superconducts at 1.2 Kelvin, by the way. So yeah, very detailed instrumentation is needed. So like I said, bicep 2 keg, all with small refractors observing from the South Pole. And I kind of mentioned these bicep. I currently provide the best LINET. Bicep 2 is observing since 2 months ago with 5 times bicep sensitivity. Keck is under construction with 4 times bicep 2 sensitivity. So we will likely, and I'm being very conservative here, reach tensor scale ratio of 0.03 just by direct scaling of the sensitivity in 3 years. Okay. So some of your theories will be ruled out. So. That's a good thing.
You're being conservative, so what's your...
Oh, you know, my colleagues in the field are much more ambitious in their goals. You know. But again, we have bicep, and I'm just naively scale bicep's achieved numbers by the number of detectors. I didn't calculate this expected sensitivity and assume you can observe at 95% efficiency without weather and et cetera. So I'm experimentalist.
And sorry, at the level of a constraint like this, you don't need to think about foregrounds being cleaned out? Or you just need
don't,
to
detect
the P-mode corresponds to either that level or some admixture of primordial plus foreground?
So I'll get to that. So it's clear that we are starving for sensitivity. So bicep has 2 frequencies, you know, and the reason for that is, you know, if you see it, you would like to know whether it's foreground or primordial, and you know, foreground and primordial B mode has different scaling in frequency. But it turns out it's a waste of space. In bicep focal point, because we are very far away from seeing BMO either in foreground or in primordial. So we go to a completely 2 millimeter, 150 gigahertz focal plane for bicep 2, and we plan to do the same for the first three KEK receivers. So the first four KEK plus bicep 2 receivers will all be 150 because we're very far from the sensitivity sensitivity target, like below R of 0.1, you know. That's getting interesting, right? So, and we are very far away from that. So after 2 years of operation, bicep, as the best experiment in the world, produced a limit of R of 0.7 or 0.6. Yeah. So we want to just put all our money in 150 channel, in 150 gigahertz channel, to do KEK and bicep 2. However, if in 2 years we see a BMO at R of 0.07, then you want to follow it up at a different frequency, at 90 gigahertz, for example. And the way to do that, the way we achieve our sensitivity is very dumb. You know, we just add more and more bicep 2 style receivers on a big platform. And what we do is we will keep the receiver, but we'll pull out the focal plane unit. We'll pull out the camera unit, as seen here. Okay, this is a camera unit. Okay, we'll pull it out and put in a new wafer with a different frequency if we see B mode. Mm-hmm. So everything is very flexible. Okay, so that's our goal.
So how many people do you have sitting at the South Pole the whole time?
In the summer, about anything between 5 and 10, because you're working around the clock to make the experiment work. And during the winter, just one. And the winter is a long one. Winter, you know, starts around February 14 when the weather starts to get really bad, and ends on November. So you have 9 months by yourself in the dark working on this experiment. Yes, yes, yes. So the entire station has about 50, but we have one designated for...
Do you want to take turns, or is there a volunteer?
Oh, they got paid well. not volunteer, no. But you do have to pass the psych exam, you know. So, it's not a job for everybody. I didn't go last year. I will go this year again. Yeah, but these winter rovers are, you know, unique species, you know. They observe for you for 9 months, and they go to New Zealand, Australia, you know, paragliding, you know, sailing for 4 months before heading back to the darkness. So it's not human to me. But they make great contributions to science. And so this is pretty much the same plot. I just blow up the BMO part, okay, because that's the interesting. So the strategy for many ground-based experiments, including BICEP and BICEP2 and KEK, is to target a very narrow, or I should say, very small patch on the sky that shows the lowest dust contamination from our galaxy. Okay, there are just too many confusing plots in the community. Sometimes people do it on purpose because it might argue, it might look nice to have that plot on their proposal, and they do that. But what you want to do for things like this, like I said, there's no sample variance in BMO. But you want to limit your survey region as small as possible so that it's as deep as possible with as little noise as possible. Until you run off the cliff and start seeing lots of lensing, but no primordial stuff. But you don't need a full sky survey for this experiment. So we targeted 2% of the sky, or about 20 to 40 degree. Mm-hmm. Okay? And we picked the cleanest part of the galaxy to do our observation. I think I'm doing okay in time. Yeah. Right. Okay? But mainly for this plot, I want to point out, even though this is logarithmic, but our improvement in sensitivity will be logarithmic in the next few years. So again, this is 50 detectors, and we have a funded proposal and effort to do 2,000, and it's happening this year. Okay.
Naive question: why are detectors like quantized? Why are they all? Why is just the number and not the size? I mean, you say 50 versus 2,000. I mean, what quantizes this?
We can't have 2.5 detectors. Is that?
No. Why do you have bigger detectors but a smaller number? Why is it always number of detectors that's this given the sensitivity?
So if you have larger detectors, that means if your diffraction limited, okay, I don't know how far this will go, but if you're diffraction limited, just take my word for it for now. If you're diffraction limited, a bigger size detector will give you better angular resolution, not more sensitivity. But we cared about temperature sensitivity, not angular resolution in this game.
So there's an optimum.
Right. For example, SPT will be great in doing this stuff, but its sensitivity to gravity wave, if they choose to do so, is proportional to their number of detectors. There is perspective. So this lensing signal is always there, and we know the rough amplitude of it. There is prospect for delens, or remove the lensing mathematically in the analysis. But that calls for a very, very sensitive measurement of this signal and subtraction. It's not just a simple subtraction, it's a very complicated subtraction. But regardless, it requires very, very sensitive measurement, not just detection of this lensing stuff. So to go beyond R of 0.02, that's roughly, this is R of 0.1, this line here. R of 0.02 is just above slightly this line. To go below, it's possible. First, you have to solve the foreground issue, which is running around here. Sorry?
Maybe you're about to say this, but the dust foreground is going
out low. For 2%, for 2% of the sky. So we don't expect to be heavily contaminated. But there's lensing, so lensing should be higher of a contaminant than dust, at least in this L range. Not in here. In here, you'll be dominated by galactic dust, and certainly not at very low L, where you're completely dominated by the galactic dust. Okay. So I'm saying there's great science to be done with lensing as well. It's a little unrelated to inflation and tensor mode. But there's great science to be done. In order to do that, and in order to remove lensing to get even better sensitivity on tensor mode, you need even better sensitivity than the thousands of detectors that I just mentioned. So that's why we proposed the polar array, which will have 20,000 detectors.
Is there any further miniaturization possible? Or can you just have to go to larger and larger focal planes?
So in the past 3 decades, experimentalists spent a lot of time trying to make each detector more and more sensitive. But we are reaching the limit, okay, fundamental limit, just from the photon arrival in the atmosphere. If you go above the atmosphere, yes, you're limited by the 3 Kelvin blackbody photon arrival. And that's obviously better. But you have to go above the atmosphere for that. For the ground-based experiment, you know, many, many experiments have achieved background limit sensitivity. So the only way is to get more and more detectors. I think I'll skip the lensing stuff. So I just want to show you the a map of the galaxy. Okay, this is the dust emission, and this is the region we picked to go very deep. And this is expected synchrotron for program, okay? And this is the expected synchrotron contamination in this region, this very dark blue region, and this is the expected dust contamination from that region. And we plotted the R limit, okay? So if we choose to observe at 150 like we did, we don't expect to see a big problem from the foreground. So, and again, right now our limit is at 0.7 or something. So we are very far. So what we need now is more and more detectors at 150, not multiple frequency subtractions.
For this line, is
there
some kind of model?
I mean,
it's well understood,
but so this dust puddle, yes, was measured at 100 micron, extrapolated to 150 gigahertz. And we have reached beyond the sensitivity in temperature of the expected dust emission in even the deep region, and we haven't seen it. So this model is not completely wrong. So it's not wrong. So this huge extrapolation in frequency is not wrong. Not wrong by a factor of two. Because we've seen, we reached their sensitivity at microkelvin level, and we have not seen correlation between our measured map and the map at 100 micron. Okay. So we have not detected dust, and we don't care about temperature, we care about polarization, so, and it's only slightly polarized. So we multiply by 5% to predict the polarization content from dust. Like I said, but again, this is subject to variation in modeling. So if it happens that we detect it before that, we will add, you know, higher and lower frequency channels to subtract it. It's all very flexible. Okay, Planck, I promised to talk.
Why higher and lower frequency channels and worse resolution?
Oh, sensitivity, you mean. Yes, and that's why we want to observe at the most sensitive frequency.
Why is that true?
Why is it true? Oh, because there's more atmospheric loading at 220 gigahertz, and the CMB has a black body radiation that peaks at a certain frequency. Yeah, so you can't do this at 3 gigahertz because you're completely dominated by this stuff. So I promised to talk about Planck. So this BMO signal is called the recombination bump. It's barely a bump. And there is a reionization bump associated with BMO at very low L, okay? But like I said, you know, there's no sample variance in BMO. If you detect it, it's there. So, you know, detection of BMO, you know, is not affected by the fact that it's located at very low L. However, the galaxy is a big thing. So if you Fourier transform this map, it has a lot of amplitude at low L. So to do anything at low L, you have to remove the galaxy because this line will just blow up at very low L. And that's what Planck claim they will be doing. Okay? It's not impossible. They've done very, very careful and complicated analysis to show that it's possible. But it is at least much more straightforward to go down in a region where you don't expect much foreground contamination. And the reason Planck is relying on that reionization bump is the sensitivity line is roughly has this slope, okay? So they are relying on this line crossing that little bump at extremely low L, if you know what I'm saying, okay? So this line goes up a little, and Planck integrate. Now, the sensitivity at L of 100 is crummy for Planck, but they rely on the fact that these two lines intersect at L of 3 or something to get air sensitivity. Sorry?
The sensitivity for polarization, you mean?
For anything. Just for this plot, if you just plot white Gaussian noise in your map and you plot it, you know, it has this slope. So that's why all the experiments have this slope, okay? And we can go down much further. You know, we have no sensitivity at that low L, but we can go down much further. We can beat Planck in instantaneous sensitivity, or sensitivity on a small patch, just and hoping to reach this recombination bump. But Planck is completely relying on very low L measurement, which is subjective systematics and foreground. So, but you know, they've done a very careful study because they have 200 theorists working on this and claim that it's possible. But the bottom line is they have to rely on seeing this bump to see the bump. Okay, so they've done simulations. So with B mode, you expect to see, you know, lots of errors like this. With injected B mode, you expect to see lots of errors like this. In other words, they're going to claim a detection based on this data. That's the best case scenario. Okay. So this is, these are all simulated data. Okay. These are all simulated data. And in this simulation, they injected zero B mode. And you know, the line scatters around zero, yes. And in this experiment, in this simulation, they injected non-zero B mode. So they claim they can detect the significant presence of B mode based on this. But, you know.
How do you extract that signal?
Well, they do fancy, you know, statistical analysis. And so the rule of thumb is if your math is more complicated in your analysis, that means your experiment is less good. Okay, like I said, I'll skip Lenzing B mode. So I'll just point out, Polar One experiment is just funded. It does not only the Lenzing B mode, but it also has all the detectors in Keck array combined. So it's a great tool for primordial B mode as well, and we can focus on an even smaller patch because this is a larger telescope. So BICEP is a small telescope, so the footprint, detector footprint on the sky is big, so it can't focus on a very small patch. This is a much larger telescope, can go down, go deep much more quickly. But this will be great for primordial B, but we have plans to do the Lenzing science, which I'm skipping, which calls for more and more detectors. Okay, so this is the dream that I was talking about. So this first one is funded, but just to entice the funding agency, you know, we made this rendering. And this will really do the delensing well and do the lensing science well, in addition to the primordial B. So if you have a good theory, you know, that will produce, I don't know, rotation, in polarization or whatnot, let us know. We'll look for it.
Is this all NSF?
So the first one is completely funded by NSF. This is located at South Pole, so it's operated by NSF OPP, Office of Polar Programs. Okay. I'll take questions.
When you produce maps of the B-mode polarization, will there be sources of lines that come from the scanning strategy?
Would that be sources of?
Line discontinuities. For example, I know that in the South Pole Telescope, in the temperature maps which we would use, there would be just due to the way that the South Pole Telescope scans the sky, you will have lines in different directions.
Oh, yes.
This would be instrumental noise and not signal.
It's not noise, it's filtering.
Even if you have zero noise, you scan the sky with a certain pattern, you get that kind of structures.
So basically, I'm asking, what is the pattern that will appear in your maps?
So our maps will be...
I'm basically looking for patches in the sky with the Ohm density and seven sharp edges.
Mm-hmm. So you have to understand, so from cosmic defect or something, so you have to understand our filtering, our spatial filtering, not map, very carefully, and prove that the signal you're looking for cannot be generated by filtering of Gaussian, the same filtering of Gaussian maps, before you can claim detection of that sort. So far we've seen instrumentation effect, or observing effect, I should say. But I must say, it's not noise. It's very well known. Once you have a scan strategy, the pointing model, you know exactly what the transformation matrix will be from the sky to the observed map. So it's a filtering.
Will you eventually be producing maps where you take out all these filtering effects?
We don't take it out. We just take that into account in our analysis when we want to derive the power spectrum or something. Was there
Are your foregrounds either from the atmosphere or from the galactic dust very different for E modes and B modes?
So first of all, the atmosphere part. As far as we know, the atmosphere does not contribute to B mode, it does not contribute to polarization period. So the atmosphere fluctuation so far has shown no polarization. Okay, so that's a good thing. And astronomical foreground does have B mode and E mode. So sometimes it has more B mode, sometimes it has more E mode, depending on what sources you're looking at. For example, the moon has only E mode, for a very interesting reason. The galaxy has both the E mode and B mode. Other questions?
So why do people do balloons at all if the atmosphere isn't an issue?
Oh, noise. So atmosphere does not generate polarization signal, but it adds more noise to your detector because of the thermal radiation.
How will this technical problem due to the low temperature that this goes
through? Yeah, it has been for 20 years, you know, but people invent various tricks. For example, I know by heart a grease to use if you want to lubricate something out in the cold by part number, things like that. Yeah. Yeah, it could be solved.
Pretty
poor
against
CMB
fall. Unfortunately. Does that get you out of the atmosphere, but does it also point? Or does it take the strategy you mentioned here and try and do it all sky?
Oh, but CMB pole will have so good sensitivity that, you know, a survey will be very sensitive as well. But, you know, it'll be even better if it can point and integrate. I don't want to see it funded today because they'll draw a lot of resources out, but there's no,
no danger in that.
Right. Well, let's say hello again.